As I've been thinking about this a little bit, I'd like to go back first somewhat philosophically and address an issue of culture and how culture is defined, I think, in both the modern, contemporary, postmodern society. And I want to briefly kind of summarize three tenets that I think are operative in Marxism and also in capitalism that are fundamental to our understanding of culture. The first one is the understanding that labor creates humanity. In other words, if you want to talk about your identity in the 19th and 20th century, you talk about what you do, your job, vocation, whatever. Commentators on society and culture, like Hannah Arendt, would say that in an Aristotelian kind of view, the human being was known as a rational animal, and now the human being is known and understood as a working animal, anima laborans, if you want to use Latin and class it up a little bit. But that understanding that labor creates humanity. Now, if that is the case, that labor creates humanity, it means that everything is understood in terms of productivity, including culture, and so culture and the values of culture become commodities. And so they can be bought and sold, they have values in that kind of understanding, and because of that, we can see within the contemporary understanding as well, culture often becomes equated with entertainment, or culture becomes equated with kinds of values exchange in terms of economically, how much is this worth, or economically, how do we value cultures? And I think that's part of what the culture wars are about in terms of valuing now people and persons economically in terms of their value and worth. The second kind of understanding that we have is, and this is basically from Hegel, but both capitalism and Marxism have adopted it, and that is that violence is the midwife of history. In other words, if you want to change anything, have a war. And we can see how that goes. If you want to change culture, have a culture war. And that understanding about how violence is pervasive in the way that Western society and Western civilization thinks about change and thinks about values. So that's the second understanding. The third one is the last thesis of Marx on his understanding of Feuerbach, and there he says, philosophers interpret the world, the task is to change it. And so it's the question that is raised there is, what's the relationship between theory and action? And when we're talking about culture wars, obviously culture has with it some senses of theory, right, about what a culture should be, what a people's identity should be, what the values of that should be. On the other hand, there's a sense of action that goes with it too. The second part of the title this evening, right, public policy. So how do we put together our theory of values, culture, people, and the kind of action that goes with it? Or do we continue to draw a wedge between the two, drive a wedge between the two, so that there's a disparity between theory and action, and we kind of live a schizophrenic existence because the two never seem to be congruent or consistent with one another? So that's kind of a theoretical overview, perhaps, on some of this that we can think about.
Maybe I can just move in with the war zone in our public schools, which is, I like your analogy, the midwife to change. And interestingly, our educational, our public school system in this United States was basically fashioned after a military approach. lots of people like Montessori and Piaget, people who were around in the 1800s, really their approach to education was very engaging children's minds, the garden approach, learning through experience. But that didn't work in our culture, in our time. So we really, what we saw worked was the military approach. You can teach a lot of people in a small space in a short time. And we really haven't changed too much from that. In our schools, and I think that they're a great thing to watch in terms of what's happening in the bigger culture. We started seeing several years ago a tremendous amount of violence in our schools, violence between children, between adults and children, breakdown of communication. And so we said, what can we do about this? We're not getting along. The rich and the poor in the schools aren't getting along. Different cultures aren't getting along. What do we do? What do? We pass laws. And we pass laws that say, for instance, Public Law 94-142, which says all children in this country have a right to a free, appropriate education in the least restrictive environment. We also pass laws that say this is what teachers have to know and have to teach. So our public schools are fighting the cultural wars in some respect by dictating what teachers need to learn and incorporate in their curriculums. And right now, the mandate is that, I can't remember the year, I don't know if any of you know the year that we in public schools have to have policies in place for multicultural, gender, fair, and handicap inclusive environments. Okay, so we are mandating that things change at that level.
It's federal law.
Federal law. Mm-hmm. States have different times, but that's going, you know, timelines. But law.
Well, let me just pick up then. And I'm glad you opened the way you did, because I think in some ways it helps me to think a little bit about the way in which we think about the poor and how this plays itself out in sort of this culture wars, and the way in which we've shifted our thinking about the poor. And I think we've always probably thought about the poor as sort of non-beings, but I think there's an increasing demonization of poverty in this country and those who are on welfare. I mean, those who use the welfare system as a way to subsist. And I think the whole attitude about who's productive and not productive and how that gets played out in the welfare system, I think really sort of pits that question about labor and the value of people who have an identity because they're in the working force. And I think the welfare reform, I don't know, it's been lately, the last couple of years, we've heard the Congress talk about welfare reform. I think I've heard about welfare reform probably for the last 20 years. It seems like to me, for the last 20 years, there's been a conscious effort to reform the welfare system. And I think the problem is that welfare has too often been seen as a way to alleviate poverty. And we know that welfare hasn't been successful at all in alleviating poverty, and has probably done a whole lot to characterize a whole class of people as less than human beings because they don't have a role in the work world. So I think we see that playing itself out, and we have a whole sort of category of people. Many of them are people of color, a great majority of them, at least publicly, are seen as people of color who have no value in the wealth, and through the welfare system have not only have they not gotten off of poverty, they've become less human beings as a result of being on poverty. And so I think we see that sort of playing itself out. Whereas there used to be a time, particularly in religious institutions, where it was the poor were sort sort of a part of the body of us. And it was a temporary condition of life in many ways. And we see that now that being in poverty is more and more a permanent condition for more and more people, and the more that becomes a reality, the more in which we see a less than human face placed on the individual who finds himself in poverty. So we can talk about that more.
I'm filling in for Jane Stroll. I don't have the foggiest idea what she would say. One of the things that came to mind...
You talked three times with her last year. You know what she said.
That's true. I probably know more. I think one of the more interesting turfs that's being fought about these days when it comes to cultural roles and public policy has to do with the nature of kinship. A subject that church communities have had much invested in over the decades and centuries of Christian church in the West, at least, and I assume in other places as well. But the whole issues of kinship are very much involved in the welfare public policy debate, very much involved in the nature of educational systems, and the role that educational institutions are asked to play are more and more the spillover between kinship systems, what traditionally kinship did, and what public education, for instance, public education. The line is much more blurred nowadays, and that takes, so the kinship issue is very much involved in public policy of educational institutions. It also has to do very much nowadays with both the issues of civil rights when it comes to the civil rights of gay and lesbian persons is very much involved in the issue of kinship, as well as it's even bordering on the issues of has anybody dealt with or is anybody dealing with, particularly with healthcare, for instance. There's a piece of kinship factor in the healthcare issues too. Quite a large one in some ways. So that's another piece of turf. I wasn't going to give any kind of theoretical background. But it seems to me one of the things that, I'm sorry I missed what Mike had to say, because it would maybe give me a jumping off place. It does seem to me that one of the things that, the places that the church plays a role and also in some ways doesn't know how to play a role. I was very involved in public policy while I was a pastor in the state of Oregon. For instance, I chaired the Governor's Commission on Hunger Public Policy for the state of Oregon. Most people in churches and church communities in general do not know how to talk about public moral issues in public forums. There's a tremendous lack of know-how. And how to take moral arguments into the issues of public debate. I also think that congregations, for the most part, the ones that I've been involved in, not just the ones that I've been members of, do not have a long history of practiced moral argument. And where you cannot assume a monolithic or a single viewpoint in congregations any longer, we need to have new practices. And it's going to take us a long time, I think, at least as Lutherans, probably some of the other denominations as well, to learn how to argue morally, and that morality is a matter of argumentation and not a matter merely of passing along a solidified and well-documented tradition. But it's actually the conflict of traditions now. So that's something, I think, a couple of things, both moral turf and something about, a little bit about.
Can I just, one quick thing. It's interesting when you're talking about policies or how we're working in public education. One of the major themes that I'm hearing in public education at conferences and naming certain goals or a goal that public education has is the statement, it takes a village to raise a child. That's in public education. So that's the all-encompassing piece.
Thank you all. What questions does this raise, or comments does this raise from the rest of the community? Thank you, Noah. Anybody else? Yeah.
One thought I have regarding public education and your comments about how people, congregations don't know really how to make those moral issues part of the discussion. It seems in our community that there is a very active, very outspoken, conservative right-wing Christian group that has indeed taken their moral issues to the public school arena and made that the forum for community discussion, and they've been actually very effective in, I don't know, promoting the dialogue as much as I have. I think that they are riling the sentiments, at least in the community. I don't know that the dialogue has gone on or that we're any closer to discussion in a really productive sense. But that group has effectively brought to the forefront the issues that they think are undermining their own view of Christianity as play on the public schools.
And the whole issue of compulsory sex education in the schools is a very well articulated position on the conservative end. They have a very well developed, long standing way to discuss sex education, whereas sort of another position is not heard at all. There isn't as much of an articulated position, sort of in a more middle or progressive or liberal point of view. But that's been in Illinois very publicly debated about that position, but there isn't the other side of it. And I'm sure that there are other places where that occurs, but it's real obvious and clear the whole issue of sex education in the schools is a place.
And that is a tough one, and it comes up periodically in a variety of different ways. For instance, in our district, they wanted certain books put back in a library, the group you're talking about, and that we had removed, which of course became a First Amendment issue, and they were moved because they were, we perceived them as very negative for children. They promoted spanking and all sorts of, anyway, you know, we've had to deal with those issues. The thought that I have is, you know, the reality is though, that when teenage children become, or young children become pregnant, the public school is the one that continues to educate them. So regardless of what they want us to do, the bottom line is we're still responsible. So it makes sense that there would be we would have the right to teach preventative information.
I think you're right. Strategically, what sometimes is called the Christian right, have done very well strategically when it comes to certain forms of public policy, which is why school districts happen to be targeted, because they're locally run. Despite some federal laws and some state laws, most school districts, most of the things, the policies there and the procedures there are determined locally. And it's easier to organize a campaign locally. But they also have while they organize locally, they also are organized nationally and cross state borders.
Is this what we want from our churches?
Right.
To be organized as political forces in the community? What I thought I heard you talking about is, or suggesting, was to be the locus of public moral discourse. And they strike me as at least possibly two different things.
Right. I can tell you what my own congregation did in Portland, Oregon. And it was over whether to have health clinics in the area, the high school in our neighborhood. And there was a very organized group of Christians that was organizing to keep health clinics out of the public high school. What our congregation decided to do is to open itself as a public forum, a place for a public forum, where the debates could be carried on. And so we invited those positions and two or three others, so there was not just a two-position kind of thing, but we tried to be a locus, be a location, be a forum, a platform, where moral argument could go on, and hopefully the better moral arguments would come out, and people would have to give reasons and defend their positions, and tell stories for why it's this way, and other people tell stories of why it's this way, and appeal to people's, to what persuades people. We found that a great service to the community because there were a few places where a vote didn't have to be taken, where the arguments could be made. And our congregation, along with a couple of others, served in that capacity. I think it's one possibility for congregations to proceed, especially where you have disputes within the congregation, which I think we had a certain amount of disputes even within our own congregation.
Well, I'm glad we got that settled, and I'm sure that there are other questions.
But why does that not happen more often? I mean, why is it? Is that happening?
Maybe it does happen.
Does that happen? And if it doesn't, why? I mean, there's certainly, everything is certainly local. I wonder how many congregations or how many people are sort of talking about these public policy issues, one of which is the crime bill, which certainly impacts everybody's community. Lots of ways. I mean, we talk about violence, the growth of violence. I mean, that seems to me to be a perfect place, a perfect topic to have debated locally. I don't know that I hear of anybody doing that.
I repeatedly hear from students as they come back sort of shell-shocked from the first and second parishes that their congregation members don't want them involved in politics. And they see that as a violation of their call or appointment to word and sacrament ministry. What they're there is to preach the gospel, and the politics are going to fall out where they fall out.
I think a lot of churches have becoming more aware of developing a sense of community. And I think you're right, there's a lot of churches out there just shy away from anybody involved in politics whatsoever. They just want to stay away from it because they know there's members of the congregation on both sides of every issue. But when a church is really developing its own sense of its community, where, literally where it physically is, where it is in terms of its congregation, I think more further reaching. Once you define an issue in terms that will fit that community, I think people will listen more, as per the local issue, a local high school, that sort of thing.
Let me run part of that back. And so once we know what our community is, or once we place ourselves within a community, then we can begin to talk about what our culture is?
Well, I think that there's a pretty big reorganization going on there. Communities no longer are our neighborhoods, they're no longer our towns and cities, they're on the airways, they're made of, you know, the commuters who live in hundreds of square miles, you know, in some of the major metropolitan areas. And I think one of the places where the growth edges of churches is breaking through all of that and saying we're, you know, community believers, and we share these goals and these situations in our lives, and it becomes easier to address something not necessarily in political terms, but in terms perhaps more down to earth, perhaps more affecting of members' lives.
But so all of these issues shake down to our lives. I mean, you might say they're political, but they all really do shake down to our lives. You know, and I'm always troubled by what are the institutions in our lives that are of meaning to us? I don't know where they are anymore. It seems like the church sort of has a vacuum role that it could play because there isn't anything else, I mean, that's sort of shaking out in community life anymore. I mean, what are the local institutions of respect? In my community, it's the Brickyard Mall. I mean, there's much more that goes on there. And you know, I'm gonna tell you something, I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that the Brickyard Mall might not have a public discussion about violence in the inner cities because they have a vested interest in it. And I would much rather have my local church play that role or those local institutions that fill our souls and our humanities than I think those other places. It's not so far-fetched to think that those aren't the places where those debates will happen because of the lack of other viable institutions playing those roles. So, I mean, it does come down to our everyday life.
Which roles now are you talking about?
Of having public discussion. I mean, I don't know if you want to couch it as moral, I mean, you can, but what I'm saying is that there isn't any discussion that's sort of being directed by sort of a moral thought, and that it isn't so far-fetched to think that other institutions won't pick some of those roles up. Maybe not debate it from a moral position, but I think that it's not happening anywhere. The churches seem to be, in some ways, a logical place to fill that role. They're not doing it.
So if the Brickyard, the Brickyard picks it up, then they're going to pick it up on based on with the focus on how can we make sure we keep our clientele safe and buying.
Exactly.
Whereas
the city's going to do it for the same reason in terms of who comes in, mm-hmm. as far as businesses too.
And what I'm saying is that if no one else is doing it, I don't care what role they're playing, whoever's interest, self-interested is to sort of pick up these issues and raise them in a public forum will do it. And if the church doesn't see it, then they will certainly give it over to somebody else who sees it in their best interest to do it. So, I mean, the point that you make that, you know, that students are saying that's not my role, well, yeah, if you really label it in a very narrow way, as this is just politics, this ain't life. Politics is life.
What's the rationale in your churches, those of you in churches that don't address political issues? Or if you do, what's your rationale for doing that? I'd be interested. Hunger, war, violence,
we have
abortion.
A forum. I thought that was a mainstay of the ELC churches making up. But we're in a big city church, and at our adult forums, we have marvelous speakers scheduled throughout the year on many of these topics you've mentioned.
Let me
also, our neighborhoods we have meetings in our parks, centers. We have lots of avenues.
Does it go beyond the forum? In terms of action?
Yeah, let me ask that question in a very crass way. Do you do anything?
I would say yes. Stuff has come from these, yes.
It seems to me that maybe this is true of your congregations as it is of most congregations. Actually, I think it's a role that congregations have a chance to play. Traditionally, I think Christian congregations have done well, relatively well, at what I would call moral formation, forming people within a heritage of moral perspective, and a moral way of being and way of life in the world. The history of many, at least Lutheran, and I think generally speaking, Protestant traditions, is that we haven't done what's often called moral justification, or coming up, or thinking about how do you actually establish new moral turf or change old moral turf. Now, there have been some situations. For instance, I think the civil rights movement has been a place of moral justification where new norms and new public policies have come about, largely, at least initially, through Christian communities. But largely, we're places of moral formation where we pass along from one generation to the next generation a pattern of moral life. I don't think we ought to disdain that as something that the church has done, does fairly well. Maybe doesn't do as well these days as we've done in the past. But it's one of the things that's also missing in much of our society today, our modern ways of society. So I'm guessing that your congregation does a lot of that kind of stuff, always has. And it's a tremendous service to the civic community as well.
Your comments earlier about the many different views within a congregation, though, is a situation that we didn't deal with.
We were more monolithic.
Even a generation ago.
Right, we were much more monolithic.
And now we're much more likely to have, well, I don't know what kinds of congregations you grew up in. The three of us grew up in German congregations, and I was one of the few exceptions in one of those congregations in the Saginaw Valley. As a Lutheran who wasn't of German heritage.
No.
Well, only a little part, actually. But we don't admit to that very often in our family.
I was always reminded how German my last name was, too. Simpson.
Yeah. And many grew up in Scandinavian background congregations. Well, you walk into a Lutheran church today in Chicago, Augustana, down in Hyde Park, and you're quite likely to find many more African Americans than Swedes. That means that you're going to have a whole different set of assumptions about what it means to be living in the United States at the end of the 20th century from what you might have at Augustana in Rock Island. This is all under the rubric of ELCA. So that even that moral formation that you talk about is happening in very different ways.
Quite different.
All the questions about first you've got an urban congregation and a rural congregation, and we get the many different kinds of cultures that we have to cross to even begin to talk to one another is an entirely different. Just to walk out, drive out to the ELCA headquarters and begin to talk to people without talking about predecessor church bodies is a near impossibility. I mean, everybody wants to know who was Missouri and who was ELCA and who was LCA and who was ALC. And I don't know. How do we... We can't get past that in the church, let alone in our communities where the diversity is much greater. So the moral formation issue is one that really fuels the culture wars. What is it? What is good moral formation today? Is one that we
need to know. Public schools are determining it. I mean, the public schools are saying, this is what, I mean, they're defining it. My question about that is,
are they though?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, there's a form of a definition happening. Absolutely. This is how we live together. This is how we work together. This is what we value. This is what, you know, what we need to do to get along, to survive. They're doing it. I mean, they're defining it. And my question is, do we follow that lead or do we move ahead? Come up with our own definition. And be a leader rather than a follower of what's already happening.
Give some suggestions. How are they doing it, and how would you do it differently? Or
well, one of the things I think they're doing, and I'm not saying that it's all right and all great, it came out of a need. It came out of, this isn't working. We're not being able to be about the business of learning when we have so many conflicts because of our differences. And the differences include different groups of people that end up in one place together culturally, but also when we started including children in that environment with a whole variety of abilities, including behavioral problems, whatever. And also, from seeing what happens when we turn the children out after 12th grade, and then they're in our society. So they said, we need to do, well, first of all, we couldn't live in that. We were hurting each other. We weren't learning. We weren't able to do it. So now there's all these things that are happening that are allowing children and teachers to be back on the task of learning. Okay. And one of the things, a major thing that had to happen, which I think we've been talking about this week, people in certainly our sessions, is the education. We need to know more about each other. We need to name more about each other. Talk about, come up with strategies to be together. And then when we know more about each other at the same time, we can maybe be more about promoting living together and working for the community. And it's exactly what you talked about doing that you did in your church. That's what schools are doing too. This is an issue we need to discuss. We put it on the floor. There are opportunities like that. But more than that, we got beyond, we forced it. We didn't just let things happen. We said, this is how many books we have in our school that deal with people who are not white. This is what the artwork has to start looking like. So there was an active element of change. We're going to value these people. This is what the language has to sound like that you use in your classroom. This is what the language has to be in the books that we're choosing in the library. It's included. And so there's active.
Then I scream, you're violating my academic freedom.
How?
By telling me what I have to teach.
We're not telling you what you have to teach.
How I have to teach it.
We're not saying you can't teach in your own way. Or your subject matter. We still do that.
If I don't think that
But you need to weave in inclusiveness.
If I don't think that there are any Japanese biblical scholars who have done any work worthwhile, and you tell me that I have to include them, then I scream you violated my academic freedom.
I wouldn't tell you had to include them. What I would say is, if you're studying a certain area, you must include what's available. If you're, for instance, studying British writers, you can't just do male, white male British writers. You have to include women writers.
Even if they haven't written anything worth reading?
That's exactly the question of the canon, you know.
Right. No, I mean that's the question. I mean, isn't that the question of what do we say is valuable? Right? I mean, the culture wars, and I put it in terms of that sense again of commodities. What is of value? And how do you define that? How do you understand that?
Well, I don't know if we're even saying, well, we aren't saying a hierarchy. What we are saying is we need to include more than just what typically has been there.
But Mike's argument at the beginning is just that we do have a hierarchy, and it's always been there, and we don't want to do away with it because this tells us what's best, and this is what this is what we strive for. Mm-hmm. And in our schools, in our churches, now we're having more and more people who come not from individualistic societies, but from communitarian societies, and more people come from cultures that have more emphasis on being than doing. And this is all smashing up against one another. So that what you're saying is to include this in what our professors from Chicago were saying, forget that stuff. It's not worth talking about because it's not productive. It's not producing the work that we want.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but they didn't go through the public.
But then the ultimate issue is then it's going to get duped out. I mean, that's the reality. It's going to get duped out. I mean, there's going to be a battle.
Are there alternatives to that?
That's the violence exactly. is the violence well, is the midwife
violence,
of history.
I'm talking about you're either going to lose people in your congregations. I mean, which is you know, I mean, I hear stories of these multi, you know, where you drive into a congregation and you plug into a whatever that are growing. And our congregations are shrinking, so I mean, it's going to be felt somewhere. So the question is either going to get duped out in debate, or people are going to go someplace else and form their own moral.
Now, what would go in? I mean, it seems to me that there is a virtue that's, or a piece of the moral formation. You used the word crossover from one cross. Over cultures and cultural boundaries and things like that. I was brought up, as most of us were, in either the version of love your neighbor as yourself or do unto others as you would have them do unto you, as a basic fundamental moral norm or maxim or something like that, which to me actually seems like it has the right intuition to it. That you do unto other people, you know, Jesus says this golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But it does seem that that moral maxim works well in a non-pluralistic, a rather homogenous kind of society, where the other person and you are fundamentally, not only fundamentally, but even to the particulars, rather alike, homogenous.
From the, so same, that, from the same family.
Yeah, from Jesus the same family and the same... Right, so I mean, so when somebody says, do unto others as I would have you do unto me, myself, the first thing you do in that procedure is you check out yourself. And then you can assume that the other people are like you, and so you would do unto them as you would have them do unto you. Now, it seems in that works in highly homogenous societies, quite a good principle. And the intuition is that you trade places with one another, and you can do it kind of with a moral monologue, by kind of descending into yourself and then projecting that out onto other people. Works well in homogenous society where most people are mostly alike. There may be a few marginalized people, but for the most part. Now, I think in a pluralistic society, the intuition is right, but the procedure misses something. I think when you have to assume that everybody isn't maybe basically alike, but that there's so many other things that are quite different, maybe we ought to think more like, do unto others as they would consent to have done unto. And then the first thing you have to do is you have to listen to them. You don't first of all descend into yourself with the assumption that everybody is alike, and then project that out onto everybody else, and then do that. But the first step, then, is in order to have their consent, you have to listen to what, in fact, they are like. You begin to, as some people call it, you begin to take the perspective of the other. It's a social perspective taking. Now, nobody can ever jump out of their own skin altogether. Especially all in one fell jump, swoop. And that's a painful kind of thing. But it does seem to be the kind of virtue that isn't among the classic virtues, and that actually comes closer to, I wouldn't necessarily call it a virtue, but it comes closer to what in the New Testament is called compassion. Or in Greek is called splagnizomai. When the Good Samaritan, you know, is not a good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan is a splagnizomai Samaritan. That's a Greek word for, it's also what happened to Judas in Acts chapter 1. Remember what happens to Judas after he betrays Christ? He goes out, in one version he hangs himself, in the other version he what? Jumps off a cliff. And when he hits bottom,
it says he's like nizomite all over the place. His insides all gushed out. Exactly the same thing that the Good Samaritan did when he saw the person on the other side of the road. His insides went out for the other person. It's just living outside of yourself into the life of the other. Now that kind of virtue is quite a different virtue than I think that, I think it's a moral virtue. It also has cognitive, it has content to it, or can have content to it.
You have about 10 minutes to get in on this discussion before I send these guys home.
Probably should have said anything.
Well, I know Mike has something to say.
I do. I've
seen it.
Keeping myself quiet all night long.
We'll give you the last word.
No, I don't want the last
word. Authority is in the last word.
Go ahead. They had their chance.
They had their chance.
Yeah.
Well, it seems that it just raises a choice for churches to either kind of model through a pluralistic society and become a reflection of that. And I think that's kind of an age-old thing for churches to want to reflect a society where you're only one. Become a leader in it. And as you guys have defined it, to be a leader in it would be to become a place where we kind of work out some of these real tough gray areas and how to do some of that with compassion. Within an arena where if we really believe the gospel of Christ, then it's okay. You and I may differ strongly on how to care about the situation at school. But if we can learn how to work that out and have a public discussion within a broader context of the gospel, then maybe we can model something for the broader society and go out and have a better impact in the world. But before we do that, I think it's a choice. And the third option is to not choose, which I think is the death option. But the first two, it is a choice. It's like Mary said, it's to duke it out. We choose to be a church where these things happen and people are more comfortable with that, either tolerate it or leave. Or we choose to be a place where these things don't happen and people aren't comfortable with that, either tolerate it or leave. And it's just going to be that way. And I sense a lot of wanting to be everything to everyone around. I'm not sure Jesus did that so well. I'm not sure that's our calling, but I don't know.
How would you define our calling, just since you're on that topic?
For me, I think we have a strong mandate to try to model something different, to take the lead. With the understanding that we may take a stance on something, we have a congregational vote, you know, it's 50 to 20, so 20 vote the 15 back up, because next time they may be on the winning side. And a year later, we may decide that was the wrong stance to take, but we know by the grace of God, it's okay. We took one. Try our best.
So there's a presumption of community before the vote's taken. And I happen to have grown up in a church where majority made bad doctrine, as far as I'm concerned. And I had to leave. Eventually, I believe.
Yeah, and I think that's okay. Yeah, I think that new communities will form on that, and the dialogue between us is where growth happens. I think we're going to have problems. I mean, the problem I see is the ELC headquarters and other churches trying to keep everybody happy.
I think one thing that's really stimulated me tonight is the idea of the church becoming a forum. I think that's an excellent idea. I read the document on homosexuality at the ELCA put out, and I never quite read a church document quite like that before, I guess. And I thought a very good example of beating around the bush, but on the other hand, they really openly said our object is to promote reform, to get people to talk about this, to bring up their feelings and so forth. And I thought that was a change. Yes. If any churches could go that direction, I think it would be wonderful. Because inclusiveness is far from natural. It's very natural to be exclusive for everybody, all of us in this room.
It has to be directly taught.
It has to be directly taught.
In a concrete way.
And I think that's what they were trying to say in their statement on homosexuality. We need to be inclusive, but we need to also teach that.
A forum is one thing, though, but I think that we have to go beyond that and do, like Michael suggested earlier, and do something. If we don't get active in politics, we're just doomed to fall in whatever other people choose for us. And I think that the greatest sin, possibly, that at least my Lutheran church has had, has been the silent kind of, okay, the world's going to hell, but by God, this post is standing still. And and I'm afraid that's the just the road sign to destruction. We have to get active or face the consequences.
There's a difference between an active, politically active church and a politically active Christian. And I think where we, in my congregation, there's a real hesitancy because of the diversity within the congregation to be politically active. And yet, through adult forums, people, individuals, are encouraged to be politically active without the church itself putting themselves in that position to take a stand.
Doesn't that create a schizophrenia in the Christian life, though? The place you come together to share values and meaning and the ultimate is a place you're excluded from acting it out. You have to go act it out by joining a political party or a blood club or a PTA.
I guess in my small community, it's all one and the same.
Or some congregations encourage internally voluntary political groups and action without having to come. I mean, there are a number of different kinds of models. Like, lots of congregations don't do things through their church council or their annual meeting, for instance, when it comes to political things, but have Bread for the World groups or. I mean, you can multiply them.
Yeah.
But again, that depends on traditions and congregations too. I don't think all congregations have to work alike. And there can be a number of models of congregations, depending on lots of factors, like how big they are, how small they are, how old they are. If their clientele is all in one particular place, or if they come from long places, distances.
I think what's been interesting, like in dialoguing about this church's statement on human sexuality, we had a couple within our congregation that were extremely active in a Republican club in town, and then the Republican club started going really. The fundamentalists in town kind of took over, and it was getting very fundamentalist. And they took an ad in the paper and said that they were disassociating themselves. Mm-hmm. That they were remaining Republicans, mm-hmm. but they couldn't associate with the way that the Republican club was going in town. They couldn't. That they still would be Republicans and support candidates.
the way of the Republican Party in the whole state of Minnesota right now. Being here from Minnesota, you're going to have a. You may have, huh?
Not only Minnesota.
You have a Republican governor that's not endorsed for the next election by the Republican Party. A sitting Republican governor that the Republican convention voted for his rival to be endorsed for the next. Very interesting kinds of things that go on.
The rival is very,
right. There's two endorsed persons. They're both Lutherans.
Ooh, boy. And that's a forum for next week. Thank you all for participating either with your voice or with your ears. And it's my solemn duty to say that the forum is officially over. You may continue the conversation. I take these very seriously. You may continue the conversation here as you have time or around the tables at lunch, dinner, and breakfast out on the lawn if it's not that the smoke seems to be subsiding. Thanks for being here tonight.